Hello, and welcome to AgTech So What, brought to you by the AgVentic Group. I'm Sarah Nolet. For the global AgTech ecosystem to grow and solve real problems for farmers and our food supply chain, it's critical that we find mutually beneficial ways for farmers and startups to work together. But we've probably all heard of cases where that just hasn't happened.
The farmer has too many scars from people that look just as smart as you with great decks that are no longer there, right? So you've got to convince that farmer, that producer, that you're going to be there next January, and that if your machine or your solution breaks down on Saturday, they will see you or someone you're working with before Monday.
That's Walt DeFlock, California farmer, ag tech blogger, and VP of innovation at Western Growers. In this episode, he's joined by Pete Nelson, the president and executive director of AgLaunch, as well as Emma Weston, Australian farmer and the CEO and co-founder of AgriDigital, an ag tech startup. This episode is an edited version of a recent Oz AgriTech meetup that we hosted live, so you'll hear me ask some questions that were sent in from the online audience. But first, I asked each of our panelists to introduce themselves by sharing the story of a failed farmer startup engagement.
My name is Pete Nelson. I'm the president and executive director of AgLaunch. We're based in Memphis, Tennessee in the United States. I started out as a farmer, and our kind of premise for what we do is very basic. We connect startup entrepreneurs that are solving problems in agriculture with farmers, and we do that very early. Farmers take an equity position in the startups in order to help provide data, field trials, access to capital, and help scale new technologies. And so we built kind of a whole network around that. And you'll kind of hear more about that today, how we do that. So I've got a lot of great failures. Most of them have to do with companies coming from the West Coast or the East Coast in the U.S. And the moment they get an introduction to a farmer, they just can't quite help themselves trying to sell. One of the things we do, there's two fundamentals we do when you come into our program. One is we teach you how to read a crop budget. I don't care what accelerator you've come from in the tech sector, even if it's branded as ag, you have no idea what a crop budget is and how farmers think about your value proposition. And they also just can't help themselves trying to sell. So we've had a really nice company out of a major university in the US around drone imagery that we put them with a large producer, 50,000 acre footprint. And all they were supposed to do was say, I want to partner with you and we're going to build a pilot and we're going to scale. So this company could have taken them from where they were, one person with an idea with about $50,000 US, they could have taken them very, very far in their business. Instead of doing that one thing, I want to partner with you. How do we work together to test this and scale this? They tried to close a $5,000 sale in the first meeting. They'll not only never get a meeting with that group again, but if you know US agriculture, you know it's a closed loop. Very, very tight community of about 90,000 people probably across the entire country. So not only did they lose an opportunity for cotton and rice in our area, they probably lost a whole lot of other opportunities. That company is no longer also in business. So that's kind of a good starting point.
Awesome, Pete. Thank you. A few good points in there that we can pick up on in terms of selling too soon and kind of burning bridges. Emma, we'll go to you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and startup plus farmer collaboration failure story, if you have one.
Thanks, Sarah. I'm Emma Weston, and I'm the CEO and a co-founder at AgriDigital, and we are busy digitizing and financing the grain supply chain. So we want to do that by powering trust and connecting participants across the supply chain, and that's the mission that we're on. I'm also a farmer, but I didn't grow up as a farmer, so I've kind of got the insider-outsider insights from that perspective, but I'm married to a farmer, so I'm married to a farming family. I guess one of the stories that comes to mind, I think one of the early failures that I wasn't actually involved with, but one of our team members was involved with, was heading out, you know, very kindly being hosted by a farmer to look at ways in which we could bring farmer intelligence into the product development process. And then effectively, this person on our team went out there and kind of told the farmer how to farm. So that was never going to be a winning strategy. And look, that farmer was able to get on the phone and give me a call and give me that pretty frank feedback, which was great because we could course correct. But yeah, you don't tell the customer their business. You know, you tell them how you can help them in their business or find out how you can help them in their business. So it was kind of a last minute save, but only because of the generosity of the farmer recognizing that we just hadn't gone about that the right way.
Awesome. Thank you, Emma. And Walt, tell us about yourself and failure story.
So, hey, everyone, Walt Duflack. So I'm a fifth generation family farmer from Central California, basically South Monterey County. We have cattle, beef cattle, about 300 head, cow-calf, and we have 1,400 acres of wine grapes and about 3,400 acres of specialty crops that we grow with farmer partners. And it's been fun to be in California the last few years with ag. Right. Apart from that, I spent 30 years in Silicon Valley at startups, not ag tech for the most part. eBay is the one most of you may have heard of, even in Australia. A couple others got acquired. And then the last 5 years, I was building SVG Thrive. And last year, I joined Western Growers as VP of Innovation, really focusing on two things: helping labor. We got to solve the labor problem with harvest automation and helping food safety. We need some fixes for that E. coli, Listeria stuff. So we're working on those. And there are some that are out there. So my failure is a fairly public one. It's Abundant Robotics. For those that don't know, the company did not make it through their next fundraise. They passed away last month, and it was sad. And I was in Yakima, and they're doing apple harvesting. And there's a lot of good lessons from Abundant. And I know the investors. I know a lot of their prospects and customers up in Washington. And I know the Washington Tree Fruit Research Commission. And at a high level, I think two things they got wrong are really useful for startups to think about. Number one, they didn't understand grower economics as well as they needed. So while they were building the right product, they were still not providing line of sight from that product roadmap to a place where the grower economics would be interesting for the apple farmer, right? Because it doesn't matter if economics are interesting to you startups, it matters if they're interesting to the apple grower that's going to buy your product. So because they couldn't provide that line of sight, the next round of funding didn't happen. And the second thing I would say is they stopped listening to the growers a little bit. And in the words of the grower, at a dinner up in Yakima on my last trip, after an appropriate amount of lubrication had been served, they said the minute the round of Google financing landed, things changed. And that's never good. So startups, when you land that funding, and again, some of my good friends are at Google and they're very smart, but when that funding lands, don't change things, just do them faster. If the roadmap is right, it shouldn't change.
Thanks, Walt. Pete, you're nodding there. One of the things that's kind of a theme here is like following that money and the difference between the culture maybe of a venture-backed startup and farmers, which we've seen work well and maybe not so well. What are your comments on how the funding plays a role in these collaborations?
Yeah, I was nodding just because there's so many interesting things in that story about how to like listen to your partner, the farmer, and how to build. But I think the biggest comment is, yeah, the capital source is really important. We continue to argue in the U.S. that farmers themselves are huge capital sources and the ones that are close to them that are sort of untapped. And so that sort of starts solving that problem a little bit of changing culture. We see the pathway to commercializing is being really interconnected with the farmer, including the capital. So yeah, I can see that the culture really, you know, even Emma's example is a great one of, for whatever reason, people think farmers are hayseeds and that everybody else is smart. And, you know, at AgLaunch in particular, we think the opposite of that generally. And so we think there's a grounded reality farming that is the platform for every other piece. So I don't care how great your startup is, they're an additive, augmented piece to a group of people that's already incredibly smart, multidimensional. It's not going to solve everything.
Yeah, that's great. And it kind of comes back to something Walt said as well around being transparent about that product roadmap. Emma, as a startup, how have you guys handled this challenge of we know where we want to go, but we haven't gotten there yet and we need to have a conversation about that?
Yeah, I don't think it's an easy one to resolve, actually. And we're still working our way through it. We have put roadmaps out there, have got ahead of ourselves, and then had to, you know, do mea culpas to customers and reorient. We've had no roadmap, which has then meant customers don't know exactly where you're going and they're reliant on, you know, your sales or your growth team, you know, giving them a consistent view of the vision and how we're going to get there. And then we're probably just getting to a phase now of how do we build a roadmap that our customers can be part of and that prospective customers can be part of. So the roadmap is not just directional, it's collaborative. And we don't have the full answer to that yet, but that's how we want to put a roadmap out there. We now realize that taking the time and not rushing is quite often a really a good way to be more successful. I know that we all feel like we need to be fast, but sometimes taking breath and doing the planning is what's going to lead to the successful outcomes.
A kind of follow-on question maybe from John Farger in the audience around how transparent roadmaps are important for engagement with early adopters and early majority, but how do you do that and still sort of protect your IP and stay competitive?
Yeah, I would say the roadmap in ag tech is interesting, right? A lot of times we focus on that MVP, that minimum viable product. And a lot of times with farmers, you're just as useful, maybe more, having the roadmap focus on exact pain points, right? So if you go back to harvest, right, and apples, there's a thing called doubles, right, where two apples are coming off the same bud. And you know what? It's a great example of a problem where you need to solve it, but you can solve it by using manual labor alongside the machine or by using manual labor after the machine, right? And so the notion of IP around how the AI identifies that double situation and solves it with the end effector doing the picking is important. But what's really important on the roadmap is to have a thing that says Q3 of 2022, I can pick doubles, right? So a lot of times you can use it on benefits for the customer without disclosing too much on the IP side. The other thing with AgTech that's different, MVP in AgTech is really product plus economics and go to market, right? Again, you are going to need to show that farmer, I can get to this number that's interesting to you. A quick example, I've seen how many weeding robots that come out and they say, hey, I can do this for $450 an acre. Well, great. You get it down by about 70%, we can have a conversation. Not 70, you got to get it down to 200 in California. And that's a problem. You can't start at a place where you're that much higher than the number that they're working with now. So again, you've got to understand the economics and you've got to understand go-to-market. The farmer has too many scars from people that look just as smart as you with great decks that are no longer there, right? So you've got to convince that farmer, that producer, that you're going to be there next January, and that if your machine or your solution breaks down on Saturday, they will see you or someone you're working with before Monday. Because a lot of times, Saturday to Monday is a problem. And a lot of times, they're in pretty remote locations.
I really like that as a tip there, because I think we probably run the risk of being, you know, not generous enough to startups. But we, you know, there are kind of give and take here if we're really talking about a true partnership of both sides kind of coming to the table. And I guess one of the benefits of startups and the benefits of software in particular is that it does improve and iterate over time. It will actually get better. And so taking, you know, the partnership on that journey can be important. How do you think about that, Pete, this kind of challenge of it might not be all the way where it needs to go eventually, but we've got to start somewhere and start building this relationship and having that transparency?
I think that's better. I appreciate what Emma said about transparency. Walt's been around farming. Emma, you've been around farming. You can see immediately the decoupling from here's some idea that we think abstractly might fit in agriculture versus something that's grounded in an actual problem. And we have in agriculture plenty of problems. When you have herbicide resistant weeds, for example, in New York Times Sunday edition magazine, these aren't like abstract things. We've got plenty that we need to regularly attack. And most often everything's decoupled from that. So I view, first of all, I think everybody probably knows on the panel, as farmers are business partners. Not there's too few of them. They can't be viewed as customers the way we view some other kind of technology that we're introducing. So that's kind of point one. I think point two is in U.S. agriculture in particular, we're a highly consolidated industry that I'm not sure is particularly effective. And so there's things that we do now in agriculture because we have to. And this is a very controversial statement. I'll make it. But we signed technology agreements with Monsanto because we had to. And there were some short-term benefits around Ready or other technologies, but we do certain things because we have to. That doesn't, in a startup, I'm not picking on the poor startups. They're following the same playbook that they see, which is a corporate, highly consolidated, not necessarily prepared for the future business approach. And so there's a very different business approach, which is partner with a handful of the about 90,000 total potential dance partners that provide 95% of the food in the US, partner with some handful of them, bring them into the business. And that's where this transparency thing kind of goes away. If you're in the business, then you you're by nature transparent to what the business is. I also think value proposition is extremely important. I mean, we're riding the end of a tech wave. The Facebook is obviously a great example where consumers are now realizing how duped they've been. Nothing's for free. They now are like, oh shit, our kids know, like, you know all about our kids and every profile, and you're selling them exactly this thing. And so that age is sort of ending. And so this defining a real value proposition with knowledge, building into your partner base of farmers, that you will have some legs. And I think, Emma, you didn't exactly say this, but I think you were sort of touching on it. But that's a very, very, very different way to build a business than the way that tech is built, especially past tech has been built in through a Y Combinator or a Techstars or whatever. Just a almost like light years different way of thinking about it.
Yeah, for sure. And I like this theme that keeps coming up around partnerships and not using the word customer or that kind of thing. Partnership is kind of like collaboration, where it's sort of easy to say and hard to actually do. One of the challenges is one we touched on before, and Stuart Smith has a question here on the language barrier, whether it's, you know, a crop plan or AI versus AI. You know, that's something I've talked about before between the tech developers and the farmers. How do we kind of bridge this gap around language barriers? Walt, does Western Growers play a role there? And do you have any insights on how to overcome the language barrier?
Yeah, no. So I had a lot of conversations with ag tech startups on this exact topic the last 5 years. And I think the number one thing that every ag tech startup should do is one of two things. First, get an ag founder, right, that knows some tech if you can. If it's too late, if you already started down the path, get an advisory board with some ag knowledge on it, right? And that can be university professors. In the case of the U.S., it could be co-op extension folks that can be experts on the ground, but somebody who knows the ag part. Otherwise, who are you going to go to for the language, right? So you've got to be able to turn what you know, because I've seen some great Silicon Valley technical resources come over to ag tech the last 5-10 years. And the ones that seem to get it the furthest and the fastest, and maybe sometimes not fastest might not be the right way to say it, the ones that seem to get it the most correctly, because speed isn't always the variable, are the ones that have some farming expertise on the team is best, but close advisors are a second. And I know, Pete, you've done some great work with folks like Rantizo and Patrick down at Grow Guru on that topic.
Can I talk about language for just a minute? I just, from my experience, farmers are really good at taking complex things and explaining them very simple. Here's a piece of metal that looks like this, and if it goes through soil, it throws it this way, or here's the way we use a vacuum to pick up a seed and knock it right in the ground. Technologists have actually built a culture of overcomplicating everything that they talk about. And that's just, again, our experience. There's exceptions to that. But, I mean, you take AI. I mean, even that just sounds so mysterious, and it's we're using very high-powered computers to figure out probability by running sequences of information. It's actually not very complicated at all. Most of the things we're involved in aren't. So I would humbly submit it's probably not, there's a, you know, two different languages. One is actually an extremely receptive ability to communicate. Others, there's really this, and I think it's generally a white male Silicon Valley thing. Sorry to pick on you, Walt, or me in the conversation, but you're actually out there. But there's this vibe of overcomplicating and gatekeeping. So I would argue for our problem we're trying to solve here, in general, we're people of goodwill. We want to eliminate gatekeeping and like just communicate clearly.
Emma, you have farmers as co-founders and you are a farmer yourself. What's been the response from, you know, investors and other farmers in raising money and in building those partnerships of having that credibility? Has it always been a positive thing?
Look, I think it has always been a positive. I can't think of any negatives from being a farmer, going through the journey to become a farmer, and then understanding the problems that farmers and the supply chain face from the perspective of being a participant. So I can't really think of any negatives there. What is a potential negative is the lived experience is sometimes difficult to share with others. And so being able to actually be the translation layer as the domain expert for customer experience through to what we need to build in product or tech, or just being able to share knowledge across the company, I think that's either done well or it's done really poorly. And if it's done poorly, then it may not matter that you have domain experts as founders or key subject matter experts within the company if they're not able to communicate and share the message and link that to the mission. So I think there's probably there's stuff in there. And I think the other one that I think as founders, as farming founders in particular, that we understand is time to value, that we need to be either transparent around how long it takes before you get value out of our product or what it takes to get value out of our products, the way that you need to engage as a customer. And I think there was a really good comment that I think it might have been Pete who made, and sorry, Walt, if it was you, but it was one of my esteemed panelists talking about the farmer as, you know, a special type of B2B user, right? It's not enterprise, it's not retail consumer, and it's sort of something in between. And that something in between has taken a bit of time for investors to understand. As farmer founders, we help, you know, propagate that understanding better.
This nuance in ag tech is so important. Finding a way to both appreciate why something is done a certain way today and how it could be done differently in the future. And as Emma mentioned earlier, you definitely don't want to go in and tell a farmer how to do their job. So how do you show someone that there just might be a better way? Here's Pete.
I mean, I would argue, again, the exception, there's a bias. And you see it a lot in indoor ag people, especially ones that made money off of technology. These people are all stupid. And I'm actually talking about all of us on this call. Probably we're all agriculturalists. We're all stupid. If you just did this thing or did it all with computer programs to figure out how you simulate environments to get the perfect whatever lettuce, then the world food problem be solved. We're all humbly saying as agriculturalists, that's just not even remotely the case. It's an ongoing, evolving battle with biology to figure out how we feed people. And so starting with that humbleness, occasionally there'll be some crazy idea that from a farmer perspective, we're like, cool, okay, there's an outlier, but that's not the bias that most people that are technologists come. Generally, if you're the technologist, you don't have an answer, but sometimes you might. If you start there, farmers are going to be totally open to the one out of 20 times that you actually have something, especially if you're helping us solve something that we're actually dealing with right now that we can't even think to the next thing until we deal with, I'm going back to herbicide resistant weed. So anyway, it's kind of how you set with it.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that. First of all, not all farmers are farmers are farmers. And so, you know, really understanding particularly where your stage of product is at and who is the kind of early adopter or the farmer customer who is suitable to be partnering with you or to be buying this product at this time, so that it becomes, you know, a journey where you're talking together about how to solve a problem as opposed to trying to tell someone that they should change because the thing that they're doing or the way that they're doing it is wrong, outdated, you know, whatever it may be. But just a bit of a story to illustrate that, you know, we would think often at AgriDigital, a typical customer for us is a larger customer with a lot of on-farm storage, you know, access to a weighbridge, really engaging in the supply chain beyond their farm gate. But there's also obviously the mental attitude, the history and the decision makers, not just necessarily one farmer making a decision, but perhaps a team or a family making a decision. We went out close to where I am at the moment in Warren to see such a farmer who we thought would fit our ideal persona. And when we got out there and explored the problem of how is he tracking and tracing his grain from paddock through to payment, he was like, that's not a problem for me. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting because it seems to be a problem for a lot of other grain farmers. Why is it not a problem? And he said, well, I've got a solution for that. So it's not a problem because I've solved it. And I said, oh, can I see your, you know, how are you solving that? And he took me to a corner of a shed, grain shed, opened it up, was during the mouse plague. So, you know, thousands of mice ran out and then pointed me to about 20 buckets in the corner filled with different bits of grain and each had a piece of paper on it with a date and, you know, a quality metric. And he said, see, I've got a bucket. I sample it. That's the bucket from the 20th of October, you know, and that's the grain type. And, you know, and I delivered it in here. And so I don't need, you know, fancy Excel spreadsheets or databases to tell me that, you know, all up here and in my buckets. And that's not to say there's anything wrong with that system. It was obviously working and working really well. You know, what would have become wrong is if, you know, I then tried to say, oh, there's a better way of doing that. You know, you can do that with technology. You don't need buckets. You know, you can do that from your mobile phone. because the customer clearly wasn't there and didn't see that as the primary problem that he wanted solved. And there were actually other things that we could solve better for him. So, you know, I think that knowing who your customer is, and sometimes realizing that you got it wrong, because although there are a limited number of farmers in the world, it's not like they're, you know, a consumer app. There's still a lot of farmers in the world. So, you know, we don't need to convert every single one right away. We need to convert the right ones who are ready to use.
I love that, because it goes back to the point before about not everyone's a customer or not everyone's a customer right now, and truly thinking about it in different ways and you know, what is the time to value for this particular customer. I want to talk a little bit about the ecosystem that sort of sits around farmers and startups and how we can enable some of these collaborations to be better without making either party in particular do the work. Pete, can you talk a little bit about how you guys connect the dots and some of the models you enable for partnerships and incentive alignment here that kind of go beyond just saying partnership? You know, is it equity? Is it advisors? How does this actually work?
And I think starting with working with, I mean, we work for farmers. So we have a group of farmers. They're now organized into essentially a co-op that takes equity in everything that we do. That's the starting framework, is how do we identify work on the problem? So we started with that. Then with capital, we've just tried to figure out how to have the most aligned capital with sort of the timing in agriculture, which by nature is a longer timing, and the output. So we've tried to the best we can to not have acquisition type partners putting capital in, but having, for example, our sister fund, Innova, that makes some of the investments is backed by Farm Credit Bank System. So there's 8 farm credits that have invested in that fund. So what they want is, you know, solvent farmers that are prepared for the future. What better way to do it than be an LP in a fund that's funding these things? Or our partner in Iowa Ag Ventures Alliance, which is a farm co-op, actively making investments in what we do. And then in terms of an ecosystem, we've tried to think, what are unique things that would help create a better environment for propelling things forward? So one we're working on now is what we call the data commons. So we're basically taking data from the startups as part of our relationship with startups that are already in our portfolio, and data from agribusiness companies that are collecting data from our farmers, re-aggregating that into various types of, you could look at soil, you could look at inputs, and then making that part of the offering back to the startup. So if you've got an algorithm, you can run it against what I would call curated data. I think probably everybody realizes that farmer data often is intentionally skewed or incomplete. So this is complete data with some farmer commentary. That would be one example of trying to, what would it really take to build an ecosystem to grow these things? And, you know, we run an accelerator program and have some farm incubation capacity and other things in addition to that.
Finding win-win collaborations between farmers and startups is key, and new ways to do this are emerging all the time. In fact, Walt, through Western Growers, is doing this through the Harvest Automation Challenge. Rather than try to matchmake between farmers and startups or set up trials, Western Growers is investing in the common infrastructure, the tech stack, that many startups will need to solve the challenges of harvest labor. This means startups can go faster and growers can get access to solutions sooner. Their goal is to automate 50% of the fresh produce harvest within 10 years. Here's Walt.
When you look at harvest, right, everybody's doing a one-off, right? So then the most likely outcome, and this is why venture capitalists are starting to dislike us, I think, in the harvest space, is you win in one crop, but nobody's proven they can A, win in that first crop, and then B, get to a second. So the addressable market's a little small. So you have to be able to build smarter and differently than some of the others that have larger addressable markets. So you've got to have an image library. You've got to build some artificial intelligence to make that image library into a set of commands for a robot that then picks the fruit or veg, for example, and gets it into the right bin. And so we're working with some data initiatives as part of the harvest effort. And this is things like Linux Foundation for Ag, working with those folks on this, a lot of Linux and ROS and ag tech already. But you know, and then that's a great example of where folks are using a common platform and saving some time and some money, hopefully. But imagine if we had an image library out there that had all kinds of specialty crops, and we had an AI source code repository where you could have a shared version of AI that would differentiate plant versus weed, ready to harvest versus not ready to harvest, and things like that. The more of a common platform we believe you can build to help the startups really focus on the two areas for harvest that matter, that AI algorithm and the end effector that actually picks the fruit and veg, the faster they can get to market. So we're working with a couple of different data partners, data initiatives to shorten that time between idea and harvest robot going live.
I love it. An example of kind of pre-competitive collaboration and industry stepping in to solve a sort of common problem in the space. I want to circle all the way back. You guys were generous enough to share failure stories. And I know that's something we talk about in the tech world, making failure sort of normalized, which maybe isn't as accepted in the ag world. So I appreciate you guys sharing those. Can we hear some of the success stories though as well? And Walt, you said you had one, so we'll start with you.
Yeah, no, I've got a recent one, and I think it's a really good example of getting a lot of the key ideas we've talked about right. So if you think about the burrow, and Charlie and team have done a fantastic job of building the burrow. And for those that don't know, it's like a little flatbed truck. It's just autonomous. It runs up and down the rows and takes the product that's harvested back to the truck. So it's not harvest, it's harvest assist, right? And I got to see Charlie's product in action at a farming operation a couple of weeks ago, and it was really impressive. Two things about it were impressive. Number one, the ag tech investor, he made it very clear to Charlie that he thought doing this across multiple crops, which a lot of venture capitalists would have wanted you to do, was the wrong approach. He said, focus and get one right. So he left the other two crops, you know, on the side, focused on table grapes, is really doing a great job with table grapes. And the Augean crew was in there with the field crew doing harvest at a really detailed level the day we were there. And the farmer was doing a great job of realizing, you know what, it can't all be Augean. I need one of my field crew that's on the harvest crew to just dedicate themselves to managing the burrow in conjunction with the field crew. So I think the two big learnings from that are, take the time to understand the problem you're solving. What Augean's solving is, I need to help make the entire crew more efficient. So how many burrows per worker, how many burrows per row, all that math is getting studied and looked at and spreadsheeted, you know, ad infinitum. And then from the farmer's side, all right, where's the break between what I can expect from the startup in this case and what I can expect out of my field crew? And they change the math of the field crew so that that one person still gets paid for the pick that results, but they get paid differently to manage the whole crew in conjunction with the burrow. I think it's just a great example of ag tech done right. And I think that's really going to help Augean scale in table grapes the next couple of years.
Great. Thanks, Walt. And I really like that there's a tip in there for the farmer side as well, in that, again, it being a partnership and both sides coming to the table. Emma, what's your success story?
Oh, I do. I love this story. So our very, very first customer in the United States basically dragged us across from Australia, right? They were like, we've been watching what you've been doing. You know, we think we're at the right stage. You know, will you experiment with us? Can we help you build that product and make it market fit for the US? So first of all, that just was like a successful start. We had many ups and downs in getting the product right. The whole family, the whole team, like it felt like the whole county was involved in, you know, making sure that we got the product right. The success story is not just that we have an enduring relationship, you know, with this particular farming family and business, very big business in the US, but that they've recommended us to others. One of the other early adopters, also a leading family, grain family in the US, then loved the product so much. And this is kind of, we're getting to my favorite bit now, that their son used to manage the grain harvest from his dorm at NYU because, you know, digital made that available for him. Found that so compelling himself, he then came and worked for us.
That's a great story. And also the to tie to some of the other themes, the timing of knowing when it was right to enter those markets and for which customers you could actually create value. So another theme there we've heard. Pete, tell us your success story.
I think somebody mentioned Rantizo earlier. That's a great example with Michael Ott being a seasoned entrepreneur, seeing an opportunity, even in a, what, you know, you always talk about crowded spaces, in a crowded space, all the kind of people were doing drones and all that, but he targeted the right thing, how to use imagery to pinpoint where to spray, and then just tenaciously built the pieces like any entrepreneur without getting distracted. And so I say our role was symbiotic. Michael and I were friends long before he started the company, but, you know, we were able to get investment dollars out of the co-op in Iowa and then open-minded us enough for our state in Tennessee to put in field trial money in order to make sure the Tennessee farmers were helping pilot and were able to kind of lift and support that business at a crucial early stage. Hopefully in 10 years, we'll see a bunch more successes out of AgLaunch.
Nice. I love it. Thank you for that, Pete. And some, I'm sure there's even more success stories that we could hear. There's a few tips that I've noted down and taken away, especially on that startup side. So, you know, not selling too soon, obviously not telling farmers how to farm, taking the time to understand grower economics, thinking about different engagement models. Is it, you know, a customer relationship, or is it an advisory relationship, a co-founder relationship, an investment relationship? So those are really fantastic tips on the startup side. I want to do a quick whip around here before we wrap on the farmer side. If you had tips for farmers thinking about engaging with startups, what would you advise them to do, or what tips would you have? Maybe Emma, we'll start with you.
Yeah, so we actually ask farmers, our farmer customers, this, you know, what made them decide to go with AgriDigital, or how did they make that decision, just so that we can learn more. But I think for farmers, doing homework is a good thing, and actually understanding, you know, what range of solutions are out there, and then probably grounding, you know, your gut feel in some recommendations. You know, can you find another farmer who has used that product before? Can you have a look at the startup's website to see if there's a testimonial or a case study of someone that you recognize and you can ping them and see if everything that, you know, was on the website was true? Failing that, you know, ring us up, ring up the startup and say, hey, I'm thinking about your product, but before I even want to have a conversation, I need to talk with one of your customers, or can you recommend me to someone? You know, I do that as a farmer myself when I'm, you know, on the customer side. And then when I'm ready to engage, I can have a really good sales conversation with the startup then, because I'm clear about what I want and that this is probably the right product for me. Just need to test a few things out.
I love that. And I think that is one thing that's maybe an advantage of working with startups over big companies, is that it is the founder sometimes on the other side of the phone, and you're talking to the people whose vision this is, especially in the early days. It's not a support line at some big company that's nowhere near the actual product development. And so that can be an advantage to get in early and actually help shape this development through those partnerships. Pete, your tips on the for the farming side?
I would say if you're the 3-7% early adopter farmer, you need to be a little pickier and actually get more out of your interaction with early stage ag tech companies. I think everybody's probably aware the same suspects end up being on everybody's deal, because if you kind of think about the crossing the chasm sort of mindset, the early adopter farmers are crazier than the folks lining up at Best Buy to buy the next video game or whatever. And so they're on everybody's deal. So they need to be a little pickier and be focused. Everybody else, I would just say, be willing to put a little more of a voice in to what the pipeline could look like, especially for U.S. farmers. We've now been so trained, first, that it was the land-grant universities, and second, that it was big agribusiness would give us the solutions, or in worst-case scenario, held hostage. So just being aware that you have an opportunity, a unique opportunity right now, to shape the kind of technologies and innovations in a way that you just have not had over the last 50 years, and may frankly might not have again, you know, 4 or 5 years out, and just understand the uniqueness of the time that we're in right now. I would also say to all farmers, if you think that the world is going to be number two corn times the Chicago price minus inputs, I would start thinking a little differently about the future, because that will not be the future, which will, on our side of the water, is probably going to give you trouble again for saying that.
Thanks much, Pete, and love the provocation there. Walt, what would your tips for the farming side be for collaborations with startups?
Well, first, a tip for Pete. Pete, you better get going. There's going to be folks looking for you. After that last comment. But it's totally true. I would say to farmers, a couple pieces of advice. Number one, say no faster. It's better, right? And it's funny. I love the Crossing the Chasm reference. I'm not surprised you used it, Mr. Nelson. I love the book as well. Fantastic book. Talks about how early adopters lead into the mainstream majority, and how tech companies need to solve one problem really well, which is another way of saying what we've said, which is tie every ag tech solution to a problem. So I would say to the farmers, if that's the case, remember two things. Number one, know your tech profile in that segment. Are you an early adopter? Are you early majority? Are you later majority? Are you a laggard? Because early adopters working with startups can work, still a high fail rate. Laggards working with startups, not going to work, right? So self-identify yourself and get out of that discussion if you're having it too early. And farmers, growers can be different segments in different areas, right? So maybe in water, you're an early adopter because SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, is forcing you into that. but in other areas you are not. So self-identify yourself, better for you, better for startups. And last thing is the one place where ag tech differentiates from conventional cross the chasm stuff is early adopters in ag tech don't get much IP protection because as we say in California, everyone drives the 101. So when Dirk Cheney got the first thinning machine and put it out there on his field, everyone watched, waited a couple of years, a couple of cycles. And when did everyone buy their first machine? When Dirk bought the second, right? So you just don't get the IP protection you get with conventional crossing the chasm methodology in other segments because farming is so darn public. So the response is build yourself a time protection window, which a lot of the growers do. They say, let me have this for 12 months, 18 months, whatever I can have it for, and then you can open it up.
And that's it for another episode of AgTech So What. Thanks again to our guests, Walt, Pete, and Emma, and thank you to Food Bites by Rabobank for sponsoring the Oz AgriTech meetup that you just heard. As a reminder, you can find links to the resources mentioned in this episode on our website, agtechsowhat.com. And if you like what you hear, please leave us a review or tell a friend about the show. I'm Sarah Nolette. Catch you next time.